Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me? Good. My name's Anna Healy-Fenton. I'm a member of the board of the FCC. Please, could I remind you to switch your mobile phones on again when you leave? Thank you. Bit of housekeeping, first of all. Tomorrow we have Mark Mobius talking to us about emerging markets. I think it's to sell out, but if anyone really wants to go, check downstairs, because he's always very, very popular. Now, today, I'm delighted to say we've got my longtime friend and colleague, Mark O'Neill, here. Now, as anyone who has worked with Mark will tell you, he's one of the most gifted journalists of our generation and an incredibly talented linguist. Now, he's very modest, and he'll be hiding now because I'm saying this. But when I used to have the joy of editing his copy, and you always, always learnt something from a Mark O'Neill story, and we used to have a joke in the office when he went on holiday as to where would he find Chinese people doing something odd around the world and come back with a feature about it. And I remember once him going off to Paris, and we had a bet running that he could not find Chinese people doing anything in Paris. Sure enough, he found illegal immigrants washing up in the back streets and came back and did a feature. And that's the caliber of journalist he is. I mean, wherever he goes, he finds stories. So I won't bore you with any more stories of how wonderful he is, because he'll get very embarrassed. But this is a book about what we used to call at home a black Protestant, a Presbyterian from Belfast who made good out in China in Manchuria as a missionary. Now, I think we're all very fascinated with missionaries and their lives and hardships and what it must have been like. And this is a rare insight to what it was like. So, Mark, over to you.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you all for coming. I know you're very busy today, so I very much appreciate your coming. And the last time I was sitting in this chair, I was presenting a book I wrote about the Tsuji Foundation of Taiwan. I don't know if any of you were there that day. And one of the members of the foundation bought 5,500 copies. So sales did well. And now they're preparing a second edition. And as I was going out, I heard one of the members of the audience say, even the Mormons wear white shirts. I think it wasn't a compliment, you know. So I was wearing a white shirt that day, and today I'm wearing a white shirt too. But today we have a different topic. We're going to speak about grandfather in Manchuria. And there are many people to thank for the production of this book, but I want to mention two of them today because this book is produced by joint publishing, Sanli and Zubanse. And I'm sure you know it. It's a Chinese language publishing house, not an English one. So we have given them an English and a Chinese version. The Chinese version was done by a friend of mine in Beijing. And they've decided to bring out the English version now, the Chinese version perhaps later. Anyway, there are two people here from joint publishing, and I want to thank them very much for their faith in this book, because it's not going to compare with Warren Buffett's investment guide or the biography of Stephen Jobs. So they're doing it not for the money. So our two guests from joint publishing, thank you very much for bringing the book out. Now, this is grandfather. He had a very remarkable life. This is where he was based in China. Even Chinese friends can't say where it is. It's far. So here's Shenyang. So it's about 90 kilometers north of Shenyang, right? That's where he spent 45 years. And this is just a very brief summary of some of the things that happened when he was there. He was a witness and a victim of the Boxer Rebellion, the plague of 1911. I don't know if you know about that. 63,000 people were killed in Manchuria. It was the biggest outbreak of bubonic plague since the Black Plague of Europe in the Middle Ages. He was there for the overthrow of the Qing Dynasty, the rule of the Manchurian warlords, the Japanese occupation, Manchukuo, and he was finally expelled in 1942. He wished to go back after the war, but he wasn't able to. So he died at home in Ireland in October 1952. So here is a photo of him and my grandmother. This is taken in front of the house where they lived in Faku, some year in the 1930s. And this was my choice for the front page. because it was showed the two of them in Chinese clothing and places them in Farku. But the editor decided another, a slightly more enigmatic picture would be better. So that's what you'll find on the front cover. And initially I didn't agree with it, but now I agree with it, because this shows them quite content. It's the 1930s, it's toward the end of their time. Whereas the photo you find on the cover is of a much earlier time. And I think you can see from his expression the what it was like to live in Manchuria, the risk, the danger of kidnapping, the danger of disease, the danger of not knowing what was going to happen the next day. And I think this photo captured it much better. Now, this is the church in Farku which he built. And this is the photo that we took in spring 1986, which was the first time we went there. So as you can probably tell, it was not a church anymore. And here was written, Nong Ye Xue Da Zhai, which was one of the slogans of the Cultural Revolution. Everyone should learn from Da Zhai, which was a model commune. So inside, there were just ping pong tables and some gymnastics equipment. That's what it was in 1986. So this is a photo of, again, outside his house, of him and the church members. That's also in 1930s. And this is a graduation ceremony. He built schools for girls and boys in Farku, and it's the same compound. It's just over here. The church is over there, the schools are over here. So this would be a graduation ceremony for those students. So I just wanted to speak a little about how the story began. So we go to 1986, okay? We're in spring 1986. So this is what Farku looked like in spring 1986. Now, at that time, I was working in the Reuters office in Beijing, and every day our job involved reading the People's Daily. So I was reading the People's Daily, and on page 8, it was an announcement saying the government had decided to open 240 new cities. So I looked under Liaoning, and to my surprise, Farku was included in this list. And Farku has nothing very distinguished about it. It doesn't have a famous temple or a famous monument. But there it was, open to foreigners. So this means someone like myself was allowed to go. So with some difficulty, we arranged a trip to Shenyang, which the government encouraged us to visit. And then from Shenyang, we hired a car and we went to Farku. Now, Farku had been closed since Lin Biao's army captured it. So it had been closed for 40 years. So they had not seen any foreigners for 40 years, especially no Caucasians. So we arrived in the town and there was no hotel, but there was like a guest house. So the mayor and the party chief were there and they were very polite and they were very nice, but they didn't know what to do because they had no experience, no training. So we were put in this room in this guest house. And I had a few pieces of intelligence about Farku. One was that grandfather's cook was living there. So the next morning, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I had to avoid the miners, because the miners, of course, would want to decide what your itinerary was. So I asked Tai Tai to keep the miners at bay, and I climbed out the window and down the back of the guest house, only 3 stories. And it was about 4:30 in the morning. And my intelligence was that the cook worked in a bread factory. And there was only one bread factory because it's a small town. So I went to this bread factory, and unfortunately it was so early in the morning there was no guard and there was no one around. So I walked into the bread factory and there was a lady cleaning the floor. And I asked her if there was a man named Mr. Zhao there who would be about 70. So she said, oh yes, he's here. And she took me to this windowsill. And there was Mr. Zhao sleeping on the windowsill. So I touched Mr. Zhao, and he wakes up. And I said, sorry to wake you so early, but I'm the grandson of Pastor Ni. That was grandfather's Chinese name. And Mr. Zhao leapt up from his sleep. And we sat down at this table, and I had a notepad, like a journalist should. And I asked him to describe the menus of Grandfather. So even it was 4:45 in the morning, he started to write the breakfast, lunch, dinner menus of Grandfather. And I learned that although my grandfather was in China for 45 years, he insisted on drinking black tea because he's from Ulster. You know, in Ulster, people love to drink black tea with milk and sugar. And of course, there's no black tea in Faku. So the cook explained that every 3 months he had to go to Shenyang, which in those days was a journey of 2 days, to buy 3 months of Lipton tea, which grandfather could drink for the next 3 months. And the ministers, of course, are teetotal. They don't drink alcohol. So tea would be the main drink. Now, also, grandfather is from Ulster. And Ulster people love cakes and biscuits. So the cook said he had to learn how to make them because they're not on the diet of people in the Northeast. So this was discovery number one, you know, to find a person who knew grandfather, who was still alive and had a clear memory of him. So my next stop was to try to discover if there are any believers there. So I asked people on the street, and they said, yes, yes, there's a Protestant community here. So I went in there, and it was a small courtyard, and there were about 12 people sitting in this room, in this courtyard. So I went in and introduced myself, and they also were quite surprised to see me. And none of them knew grandfather personally, but they knew of him as the man who brought the faith to the town. So one of them was about 75. He had very tanned skin, a lot of wrinkles, and very dark because he was the farmer. So I didn't understand much about China then, so I didn't know quite how to address these people. So what I said to them was, well, grandfather came, he passed on this religion to you, and then he left, and then the communists came, and you suffered a lot because of this religion. So in some sense, grandfather is responsible for the sufferings that you endured at the hands of the communists. And this farmer, this 75-year-old man, looks me straight in the eye and says, you are completely mistaken. It is we who should thank him for coming, because if he hadn't come, we wouldn't know about this. So, you know, I had nothing to say. So then we explored the town a little more, and we found the church was still standing. We found the schools he built were still standing. And we found the house that he lives in was still standing. So I went into this house, and it's not a house anymore. It's like a small plastics factory. So I was chatting to the workers in the factory, and one of them leant on the floor and produced an envelope, or half an envelope, I should say. So on this envelope was written my grandfather's name, address, and a UK stamp. I mean, you can't imagine this. You know, more than 40 years have passed, all these things have happened in China, and this envelope has survived. And this man was very happy to give me the envelope. So I think you can sense what I was feeling those 2 or 3 days, that although he had been gone a long time, and a lot of things had happened in Faku in those 40 years, his physical and spiritual legacy was still there. So here we have a couple of photos. This is another house of the missionaries, not grandfather, but there were some lady missionaries, single ladies. So this is where they lived. And I have to tell you the story about the children also. Now, the children had never seen a foreigner. And children, you know, are quite honest. You know, they don't lie, not like their parents, you know. So whenever I walked around the streets, I had about 50 children walking around with me. And they were very charming and asked me lots of questions. And I just give you 3 of the questions. One of them was, how do foreigners eat? In what way do they eat? Another child said, your noses are too big. How can you breathe with these such big noses? And then another one said to me, in your country, everyone speaks Chinese? So what did I answer? Of course, yes. Everybody in the world speaks Chinese. So they were very happy to hear this. So this is the same church in 2009, which was our last visit. And it was October, and this was the first snowfall of the year. And it was the day we visited. So it just was a reminder of the winter. I mean, this was October. It gets much colder for the rest of the winter. Okay. So let's just go back a little in time and explain where Grandfather came from. This is the house that he was born. It's a very middle-class house, very near Queen's University in Belfast. We did a lot of research, but we couldn't find out much about his parents, other than there were seven children. So I think his father must have been a civil servant or a work in a bank. I mean, a middle-class job. And Frederick was a very able student, and he studied in the Royal Belfast Academical Institute on the left, and it has many famous alumni, including the man who designed the Titanic. And I don't know if you remember the film. There is an Irish actor called Colin Firth. He played that character, and you remember the ship goes down, and he won't leave. For me, it was the most moving character in the film. Anyway, he was one of the many distinguished students from this school. Also, Robin Hart. Does that name mean anything? The man who ran the Chinese customs for 40 years. He was also a graduate of this. So then Grandfather went to Queen's University, and then he went to the Union College, where the church trains ministers. So that's where it is. So next Thursday, that's where we will be. Next Thursday, we're going to give this presentation in this place where he studied and where he worshipped. And I'm pleased to say the head of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland is going to be with us. So this is going to be a very memorable occasion. Now, this 40-year period until 1914 was the peak of Belfast. Now the city is only famous for the Troubles, and it's very unfortunate. But at that time, Belfast was a really key city of the British Empire. It was a huge producer of ships, of heavy engineering products, of linen, of tobacco. It was very much part of the imperial enterprise. So these buildings sort of reflect this. The left one is this very large and handsome church where my grandmother grew up. Her father was the minister there. And this is the headquarters of the Presbyterian Church, even until now. So he left for China in 1897, in September. So why did they go to Manchuria? Well, the Protestant missionaries had been in China for nearly 100 years. And China was divided up, just like IBM sort of sales team, you know. So the Methodists and the Lutherans and the Anglicans, you know, they all had the best parts. They had Hunan and Fujian and Guangdong and Shanghai. So by the time my grandfather's church came, the only thing left was Manchuria. And I'm sure some of you have been there, but it's the most difficult part of China. It's got the worst climate. It's very rough area. It's only recently been settled. It's rather got a frontier mentality. So it was very much, that's what it was like when he was there. So these are the names they used at the time. This is Yingkou, Jinzhou, Shenyang, Changchun, Jilin, and Harbin. So grandfather's town is just there. And this is what the missionaries went to do. I know it looks like a sales targets map, but yeah, this is every year they had to report at the end of the year what their converts were. So that's what it looked like. So he'd only been there for 3 years, and then we have the Boxer Rebellion. I'm sure you know about the Boxer Rebellion. In the Boxer Rebellion, there were two targets. There was Yang Guizi and there was Er Guizi. Yang Guizi are foreign missionaries, and Er Guizi are the Chinese believers. So on July the 8th, 1900, my grandfather was walking along, on the street in the town of Farku, and there was a notice on a lamppost saying that in 3 days he would be executed. It was written, July 11th, we are going to execute the Yang Guizi. That's execute him. So he had to decide what to do. So, of course, there was no option, but he had to escape. So I can't say this was the card on which he escaped, but it would be something similar to this. So he fled to a place called Tierling, and in Tierling he took a train to Khabarovsk in Russia, and then to Vladivostok. So he had to wait there until the Boxer Rebellion had been crushed. So here is an image of the foreign armies that came to crush the Boxer Rebellion on the right-hand side. So for this, I have to thank my translator in Beijing, because when I studied history, I only learned about the atrocities committed by the Boxers against the missionaries and the Chinese believers. But of course, my friend in Beijing, who has an education in Beijing, they are taught about the atrocities committed by the foreign troops. So I thanks to him, we were able to add this to our both English and Chinese versions. So the foreign troops behave very much the same way as the Boxers did, which is to say they killed civilians, they raped women, they plundered homes, temples, palaces in Beijing, they took anything what they wanted. It was a really horrific episode. So I think if I'd been grandfather after this experience, I would have said, well, the Chinese don't want us. Let's go home. Let's go to another country. But these people have their mission. So he had to go back and rebuild. So this was the first thing he did after he went back. This was the church. We've seen two images of it. So that's what it looked like when it opened. So this opened in 1907. He also built a primary school, middle school, and a school for girls. Now at that time, girls in Manchuria had no education. The only girls who were educated were the children of rich families who chose to invite teachers to educate them privately. So this was one of the revolutions that the missionaries brought. They had a school for girls, a school for boys, and there was no minimum fee you had to pay. The principle was you paid what you could afford. So if you're from a wealthy family, you paid more, and if you're a modest family, you paid less. And the aim was, if your parents had no money, you could still attend. In 1904, we had the Russo-Japanese War. And as you know, this war was not fought in Russia or Japan. It was fought in Manchuria. And the town of Farku, where grandfather was the headquarters of the Russian army. And the Russian officers used to come to my grandfather's house for meals. And they drank a lot. And they wouldn't leave. And it was hard to get rid of them. And then the Russians lost the war and driven back. And then the Japanese came and put their base in Farku. So instead of Russian officers, my grandfather had Japanese officers who came for meals. And they didn't drink much. They would eat just what you gave them, and they would leave immediately after the meal was over. So it was less interesting, but it was simpler. And when the commander of these forces, a man called Maruseki Nogi, who is known in Japan as the hero of Dalian because he defeated the Russian army in Dalian. When he left, he presented my grandfather with a ceremonial sword. So this detail we've left out of the Chinese edition. I don't think it would go well in China. Okay. So here's a photo of the grandmother and three sons. So this is my father in the middle. Now, there were two other sons, and who died in Farkhul. And it was very tragic tragedy in both cases, because on both occasions Frederick was not in Farkhul at the time, because his parish was very large. So he had to spend a lot of time going from one village to another, and the roads were terrible. It was just dirt tracks. So in the case of the first son, Patrick, who died in 1908, he was 3 days away, so he wasn't present for his illness, and he wasn't present for his death. So it was a very sad, sad thing. Now, this is another missionary who was in Farkhul, and her name is Isabel Mitchell. And what the Presbyterians tried to do in every station was have a school, a church, and a hospital. But it was very hard at that time to find any doctors, because in China at that time there were very few places training Western doctors. So the only thing was to get a doctor to come from home, and that was very difficult. But this lady from Belfast, she agreed to come. And she also is a very remarkable woman, because Britain at that time was very sexist. It was very hard for a woman to get a medical education. So she went to Glasgow University, which was one of the very few that allowed women to be educated as a doctor. So she came to Farkhul, she raised money from local people and from people at home, and she built this hospital. So there she is in the hospital operating. So in 1916, there were 111 major operations and 7,900 treatments. But in March 1917, she was treating a patient, and the patient coughed in her face. And she developed diphtheria, and she passed away in March. She was only 37. And I hope you'll read the book, and I think you'll find the most moving chapter is the one dealing with this lady doctor, because her death was a tragedy, of course, for her family, for the missionaries there, for the town of Farkhul, because she was the only doctor there. And I think my grandfather felt so guilty about this, and how he was to explain this to her family, that he published the book of her letters from her to her mother. And I think the value for us of these letters is they were not for publication. They were what she was thinking and feeling at the time, and she expressed this in the letters. And it's difficult for us to know what the missionaries were really thinking and feeling at the time, because so much was more, you know, official kind of language. But this is her real thoughts. So I think you will find it extremely moving to read those, because her feelings are divided completely between great pride and joy at what she's doing and hatred of this terrible, backward, dirty place, and why can't I go home and have a nice husband, have a normal life, you know. The letters reflect these two emotions, these contrasting emotions. Now, the next thing I want to show you is, this is a medal which my grandfather received from the Chinese government, from the Beiyang government in 1920. Okay? And this wasn't for his work in Farkhul. I wish it were for his work in Farkhul, but this is for his work in France, because 100,000 Chinese workers went to France and Belgium to help with the Allied war effort. And the British and French armies had no experience of handling this enormous number of people. So they invited all these missionaries and these people, these foreigners in China with some experience, to come and look after these workers, to minister to them, you know, when they were not working. So grandfather was there, and he worked in this enormous hospital in Picardy, and it had 2,000 beds in it, and it was the biggest Chinese hospital in the world. It was in France, but it was the biggest Chinese hospital in the world. So he was working there, speaking to the sick and the dying. He wrote letters for the patients. He conducted burials, and he arranged performances for them. So at the end of the war, the British sent all the workers back to China, But the French side were more liberal, so they allowed them to choose. So most went back to China, but some remained. So the French, the Chinese community in France today is descendant of these workers. So he was there for 2 years. So he returned in the autumn of 1919. Now, I'm sorry, I'm just a little wrong with the time here. I mentioned in the beginning the plague in Harbin in 1911, and I've got a very detailed description of it in the book. And I was able to get some of the photos of this plague, and it was a really terrifying incident. It was something like SARS in 2003, and when it happened, nobody knew what it was. Nobody knew how to treat it. And it was due to a very remarkable Malaysian Chinese doctor who did an autopsy on one of the victims that they discovered how to treat this disease. So one of the ways they dealt with it was to quarantine all the patients. So they put them in these trains. You see, there they are in the trains, and then these are the nurses and the guards, and they couldn't let them leave. They had to be quarantined for, I think, 45 days. And there were many heroes of this story, and one of them is a missionary by the name of Arthur Jackson, who had just been in China for a few months, and he volunteered to go and treat these patients. And this was early on in the plague, so they didn't know what it was, and he contracted the disease, and he passed away, and he was in his 20s. And I'm very pleased to say that in the room we have a relative of Arthur Jackson. Yes. So let's a round of applause for Arthur Jackson. Okay. How are we doing for time? It's okay. Okay. Well, we'll just quickly over. These are the Presbyterians believed in localization, so they wanted to pass the power from the foreigners to the Chinese. So these are the ministers and the medical staff that they are trained to take over from the foreigners. Here's a photo of the missionaries' meeting. So now we come to the Japanese invasion. We have a ceremony for a missionary who's leaving. The war was a very dramatic time. He was put under house arrest. He wasn't in a prison, he was under house arrest at home. And he was finally taken away in May 1942. And this is what my grandmother wrote in her journal about that day, the day of leaving. And I can't comment on it. It's so moving. So then he comes back to Ireland. There's a prisoner exchange in Mozambique, and he spent the rest of the war in Ireland. Okay. So I leave out a lot of things. I was going to end the book in 1952 when he died, but what has happened in the last 10 to 15 years is so extraordinary that we couldn't end the book there. Because now, while Christianity is declining sharply in the West, including in Ireland, in China and in Korea, it's the reverse. So the estimates now in China are about 60 to 70 million Protestants. This is the last surviving missionary, this elderly lady. And she unfortunately passed away two years ago, but we were able to visit her before she passed away. And this is our visit in 2009. So this is the church is now refurbished. It's back being used. And I'm afraid I'm not very well dressed that day, but these are the two ministers there now. Okay. This is the daughter of the cook I mentioned in the beginning. This is the daughter of the cook and her husband. And these are the two ministers of the church in front of the plaque for the martyrs of the Boxer Rebellion. Okay? Sam, can you? Now, this is a bit of light relief for you, these last two items.
拍照，也可以拍那个
录像。
像是昨天我们去观光，
就
在场的。
And this is where grandfather would have sat. This is the seat.
Good. 是你们能穿吗？我可以说很多很多话，但是没有内容。他还说扣税入国茶，扣税，入国茶，茶叶的茶，这是说很多话。
Okay. Thank you very much.
Now, if anybody has any questions, we have a few minutes. Could you raise your hand and give your name and where you're from, please, and the staff will pass around microphones. Okay, well, I have a question for you, Mark. Going back to that time, was there, we're both Irish, was there pressure on young Protestants to go forth? Because you hear of Catholics having this kind of vocation, but as a Protestant, growing up in the South, this would have been anathema to us, the idea of a vocation to go off to somewhere in the middle of nowhere.
Well, I mentioned that Belfast was part of the imperial enterprise. So in his school, my grandfather would have had people who joined the British Army, joined the British Civil Service, would have gone abroad to work in companies. So I think they have the mentality, a kind of global mentality, no visas then needed.And I think there was a great missionary move in the last 30 years of the 19th century, you know, that we must give something good to these countries that we've invaded and plundered. Yeah. So I think, you know, they had the confidence to go abroad because they had this global outlook and they had the faith that they felt was they should impart to the Chinese.And, you know, just like today, China is the world's biggest market for deodorants. You know, China was the biggest country in the world that had not been Christianized. So from a, you know, from the idea of the church, it was the number one target.
Okay, well, if there's no more questions, I will... Anyone? Someone put your hand up?
Just a more practical question. Now, you had a lot of old photographs there. Where did you dig all those up from? Tell us
That's
a little bit
about it. That's a very good question. When we started, we had very few photos.And of course, this is a big problem if you're writing a book. But what I discovered is from writing it, all kinds of people that I never knew before, relatives, church people, you know, heard about the book, and they sent me these photos, and they didn't want payment. So we were able to get a large number of photos. And we also found many in the library of this Union College that I showed you. They have a very excellent library, and they have a monthly magazine of the missionaries of the church since 1853. So in this magazine, there are many excellent photos. Now, unfortunately, the quality wasn't good enough to use many of them in the book, but there were many images there.
Okay. Anybody else?
Oh, please.
Yeah, I'm Toh Han Chi from the South China Morning Post. How did the Chinese converts under your father's church...maintain their faith through so many different Chinese governments, including the Chinese Communist government?
That's another excellent question. All I can say it is thanks to God. There's no other explanation, because as you say, they've been through so many periods of persecution and marginalization I was astonished that there were any at all when I went in 86.But now, as you know, if you've been there, the numbers are growing every year. So when we last went to Shenyang, we went to this church which the Presbyterians built, and every seat was taken. The corridors were full. They had to rent neighboring buildings and put a sound system because there were so many people. So it's such an extraordinary contrast with what's going on in the West. So I think we have to call the...PR man up there to get the correct answer to this question.
Okay.
Please.
Another one? Hi, Mark. My name's Kwan Ip from English Language Institute in China. I'm wondering, did your grandfather leave any diaries or, you know, his kind of own internal thoughts about his time? So did you write this book? very much as an outsider looking in, or were there some aspects of it being an insider looking out?
Very much the second one, because he wrote three books, and he wrote reports every month for this church magazine. So this is not my book, this is his book, because the material comes from his writings, throughout his period, the letters that my grandmother wrote, and we also have some excellent accounts by other missionaries. For example, he was able to be repatriated in 1942, but many missionaries were not repatriated, and one of them was in Kobe and then Nagasaki. So he was in Nagasaki on the day that the bomb fell. So in that chapter, we have the account of this minister describing his imprisonment, describing what it was like in Nagasaki, describing what happened on that day, and then what happened after this day. So, no, this is not at all fiction or faction. It's all based on real accounts.
Okay, we'll take two more questions.
Philip Bowring. A couple of questions relating to how Chinese perceive some of the aspects of history here. You referred to the plaque, I think, commemorating those who died in the Boxer Rebellion. How is that perceived today in that community? And the second question is, why do you propose to remove the reference to the Japanese sword presentation from the Chinese version of your book?
Well, I think the market for this book in Hong Kong and Taiwan is quite limited, because in Hong Kong and Taiwan there are many missionaries, there are many churches, you know, people are very much familiar with this story. But in mainland, the story is very unfamiliar. So what I hope is joint publishing will decide to publish our Chinese version in the mainland. Well, as you know, there is a very strong censorship system in the mainland. So I'm trying to write this book in a way to avoid the censorship, because I would like it to be published rather than not published because of some references. And I mean, this sword was simply a present to my grandfather. It had no military meaning. It was just like green tea or a kimono or something. But given that this is such a sensitive issue in mainland, that's why I thought to leave it out. First question was how... in the early years of the communist period, the Boxer Rebellion was regarded as patriotic, as the necessary reaction of Chinese oppressed by foreigners, that they had to take action against this foreign invasion, and the missionaries were the easiest because they were not armed. Many of them lived in the interior. They could be attacked, whereas the foreigners in Shanghai and Beijing, they had foreign soldiers protecting them, and they're much more difficult to attack. So it was quite a simple version. But now the version, the account of the Boxer Rebellion is far more ambiguous, and it's portrayed as a good and a bad thing. And I hope you will read what my grandfather wrote about his analysis of it, which was that it was the result of the foreigner's mistake. That's what he wrote. It's very hard for us to imagine the anti-Chinese hysteria in 1901, after the atrocities of the Boxer Rebellion come out. You know, many children and women had been killed. But in grandfather's analysis, which I put in the book, he says the blame is with us, because we have left the Chinese with no option, because we have not behaved well in China. So he said it's a question for reflection, and we must take lessons. So the lessons that the Presbyterians took was to localize as soon as possible, because the Chinese said, Yang Guizi, you know, the foreign devils, Er Guizi, the secondary devils. That means that Christianity is a foreign religion. So what grandfather said was, no, we must make it a Chinese religion. So if you have Chinese ministers, you have Chinese doctors, you have Chinese elders, you have Chinese teachers, then no one can say it's a foreign religion. So they started to do that immediately after the Boxer Rebellion. And they set up a theological college, a medical school. They trained a lot of teachers. So by the 1920s, the foreign missionaries like grandfather were not really key figures anymore. I mean, the the Chinese ministers ran the operation, and the foreigners were there like advisors and teachers.
Okay, well, it's 2 o'clock, so I think we'll wrap it up there. So all that remains for me to do is say thank you very much to Mark and give him the FCC present.
And, as I'm sure you know, it's not easy to sell a book about religion and missionaries, so if on your way out you want to stop for 30 seconds and buy a copy, that would be very, very helpful.
No pressure or anything.
I'd be happy to sign it for you.
Mark, while you're here, and I will pay for my own. Okay, thank you very much, everybody.
Well, I'm sorry. My wife bought it for this story, and she could do it.
Hiya.